From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, Syrians take refuge from the civil war in an ancient burial site. Egyptian police are accused of collective punishment. And we travel with John Kerry on his first overseas trip as Secretary of State. Syrians have reached an appalling milestone. The United Nations has now registered its 1 millionth Syrian seeking refuge outside the country. The situation is even worse for those who've stayed behind. NPR's Kelly McEvers met families in their makeshift homes in Syria's Idlib province.
We're walking on this kind of muddy, rocky ground that's just got new grass, wild daffodils, and stones. And then you walk up upon this and you realize it's the ruins of an ancient city.
It's known as a dead city. It's one of hundreds of its kind across northern Syria. Now it's a UN World Heritage Site. These cities date back to the first century and track the transition from ancient pagan Rome to Christian Byzantium.
You can still see columns, doorways, arched windows.
These cities were some of the most developed rural settlements of the era. Up until recently, they were deserted, frozen in time.
And then peeking out of the ground are smokestacks. People have put their wood-burning stoves into the ground where they're living.
We meet one family who invites us downstairs.
It's raining a bit, so it's kind of muddy. Stairs are a bit slippery.
We walk down a dozen or so worn steps through an ornate Roman doorway and into a dark man-made room. We had been told these people were living in caves, but it's clear this is something else. The young father's name is Abu Khaled. He, his pregnant wife, and his little boy escaped their village at night when the government shelling got really intense. The next day he went back and found their house had been destroyed.
We were just running away from shelling and we would be staying here in the forest and among the trees on the hills. And then we found these caves and, for example, it took me a month and 5 days to clean it from the sand.
Abu Khaled calls it a cave, but it's really a grave, an ancient burial site. He says digging out the grave and living underground was the only way to stay safe from the shelling and the rockets. We ask him if he found any remains.
A whole body, like a body skeleton, and he buried it.
Abu Khaled says as a Muslim, it's not right to desecrate a grave, so he buried the bones again in the bed-shaped area where we're sitting. We ask him if it's strange to sleep next to such a place. People who are alive are much scarier than people who are dead, he says. Abu Khaled says some 40 families now live in graves across this ancient city. When we hear rockets landing nearby, we understand why. Abu Khaled and his family have been given a few blankets by locals, but other than that, zero international humanitarian aid has made it this far into Syria. Researchers who study the destruction in Syria say it's no wonder there's nothing to be done to protect such historic sites. Not only are people living in them, but they're making a living from them. Before we leave the dead city, we meet a man and his son who show us some stones that look like they've been recently unearthed. They say the diggers have been here. They usually come at night.
So they say that this is part of a church.
Yeah.
And that 2 days ago, some people from here came and broke it.
Yeah.
And took the mosaics.
From here. And then
sold them?
Maybe.
Antiquities experts say there are well-established networks for selling such artifacts here in the region, especially after the looting of art during the Iraq War.
Yeah, it's just white and blue mosaic buried here in the dirt.
One Syrian Bronze Age artifact that was thought to be looted recently sold for $400,000. Experts say the only way to stop such trade is to go after the people who buy the artifacts and to help the people who are desperate enough to dig them up and sell them. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
In Egypt, the police force was the underpinning of former President Hosni Mubarak's iron-fisted regime, and it quickly became the enemy of Egypt's revolution. Yet since Mubarak was toppled in 2011, there's been little to no reform of the police force. Human rights groups say the police have begun to act like armed gangs, doling out collective punishment in restive areas across the country. The police say they are the victims, under constant attack by anti-government protesters. NPR's Leila Fadel reports.
On February 16th, a young policeman named Hisham Taima was shot and killed as he responded to an armed dispute in Beni Suef, a city of more than 200,000 people in the Nile Valley south of Cairo. But the man accused of killing the police officer was not arrested. Instead, Hossam Abu Rikad was punished brutally and publicly. Mourners from the policeman's funeral grabbed Hossam off the street. A mix of gun-toting policemen and relatives of the victim beat Hossam unconscious, stripped him, and put him on top of a truck. Bloodied, beaten, and unconscious, he was driven through the main streets of Beni Suef as a warning against cop killers. All of it was caught on tape. All of it happened in front of top officials in the province, witnesses said, and not one tried to stop it. Later, Hossam's family and friends stormed the hospital where he was being treated and took him away. The police were all powerful under Mubarak, and their widespread brutalities provided fuel for the uprising. But 2 years after the revolt, there's been no reform. And in fact, the abuse has only worsened, says Karim Medhat Annara from the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights.
The police is very obviously acting like, and it's not acting as a law enforcement agency. Not that it's ever been a professional law enforcement agency, but it's acting like an armed gang or a militia with their own interests that they're trying to protect.
Annara has been documenting police abuse since the revolution. In just the past 2 months, he says more than 60 people have been killed in clashes with the police.
It's very clear to me that they believe that they're in conflict with the population, and they just want to be armed to teeth and to have less regulation over how they can use force and firearms.
But the most disturbing development, he says, is the collective punishment police are raining down on neighborhoods across the country. In December, after a policeman was killed in the city of Minya, police terrorized a whole neighborhood and killed a 9-year-old girl, Annara says. All of it is documented on video. When a policeman was killed in Suez, police responded by firing indiscriminately, killing 9 people. And in the Suez Canal city of Port Said, where clashes with police have been the most violent, more than 40 people were killed, 5 policemen were among the victims, and the violence there continues. Instead of enforcing rule of law, Annara says, the police are taking revenge. But the police see things differently. Deputy Minister of Interior Ahmed Hilmi says his officers have become the favored target of protesters who torch government buildings, attack cops, and goad them to fight. Chain-smoking in his spacious Cairo office, Hilmi denies any wrongdoing. He rejects accusation after accusation. A young man who disappeared during a protest and was later found dead with bruises on his body and strangulation marks on his neck? He was hit by a car, says Hilmi. A man who was beaten and stripped by police on live television? The police didn't strip him nor beat him, Hilmi says. Excessive force in Port Said that left dozens dead? What would you do, he asks, if citizens were trying to break into a prison with weapons?
Implementing human rights and protecting human rights has become a main foundation, the main belief of all those working in security bodies. Those rumors about us are because of political conflicts, and there is no proof.
But then he adds this.
Do not expect us to protect the human rights of a criminal. I will not consider human rights for a criminal when he does not consider the human rights of citizens on the street.
Hilmi is angry. Angry that the police have become a buffer between the government and protesters. Young police conscripts work 24 hours a day, sometimes for 20 days straight. They are being hit with rocks and Molotov cocktails. Some are even being shot at.
Where is the red line? Protesters in the U.S. or in Europe stand with a poster that says, down with Obama, I want to work, right? But they do not carry weapons. They don't fire birdshot. They don't attack with Molotov cocktails. They don't throw rocks at the police.
The police can only take so much, Hilmi says. Already, policemen are protesting, demanding more weapons, higher wages, and protective gear to deal with protests against President Mohamed Morsi's Islamist leadership. If protests continue like this, says Hilmi, the police force may collapse. Our goals are simple, he says, justice and security. Back in Beni Suef, in the alleged cop killer's neighborhood, residents say the police neither brought justice nor security. A young man named Ahmed Mohammed unlocks the gate of an apartment building and beckons us to follow.
Broken the door.
They kicked the door in?
One apartment after another is ransacked. The doors are splintered from being kicked in. On the floor, smashed china, a broken portrait of a young girl, a toilet bowl pulled up from the floor. One is the home of a newly married couple, another a family of four. There are about 30 apartments in all that have been destroyed here. Those who lived here are staying with friends and family, unable to pay for the repairs to make their own homes livable again. They are taking revenge, Ahmed says. We don't matter to them. When the police come, they say what the officer's brother said when he was killed. No one will sleep in a bed in this neighborhood when my brother is sleeping in the dust. As we walk out of the building, a woman lunges towards us. She is Hussam's aunt, the man accused of killing the policeman. We follow her to the street outside her home. She goes to a table set up on the unpaved road for all to see. She picks up Hussam's bloody clothes and shows them to us. A young girl, also a relative, shows us her black eye where she says the police hit her. Hussam's father and uncle have been taken by police, but Hussam is no longer in Beni Suef, the family says. He's being treated somewhere safe. Mahmoud Haroun, who runs the emergency room at Beni Suef Hospital, tells us what's happening here is the breakdown of the state.
There is no law, no rules.
Leila Faldin, NPR News, Cairo.
We're starting to see a different side of John Kerry now that he's a globe-trotting diplomat as the new Secretary of State. When the former senator from Massachusetts ran for president, he downplayed the fact that he speaks French. That's a tad elite for a candidate. Now he can flaunt his French. NPR's Michelle Kellerman filed this report on what it's like to travel with Secretary Kerry during a trip to 9 countries through Europe and the Middle East.
At first, we heard a lot about bike trips, how Kerry's mother, who was born in France, rode on a bicycle with her sister and friends out of Paris as German troops approached during World War II. And then there was this often repeated tale of a 12-year-old John Kerry living in Germany with his diplomat father, having his own bicycle adventure in communist East Berlin.
When I came home, I told my dad, and he got very upset with me and said, you could have been an international incident. I could have lost my job. Blah, blah, blah. So I lost my passport, and I was grounded, and I never made another trip like that. But I've never forgotten it.
The new Secretary of State was eager to show off his international experience and his ear for languages, whether in German, Italian, or French.
Nous venons de conclure un de ces merveilleux déjeuners français qui n'ont...
In a gilded room at the Quai d'Orsay, Kerry thanked the French foreign minister for one of those, quote, wonderful French lunches that have been drawing Americans to Paris for centuries. Now I will speak in English, he then said, because otherwise I won't be able to go back home. He got so used to speaking and understanding the various languages on this trip that he forgot at one point to listen to the translation at a news conference with Turkey's foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who seemed to get a kick out of it.
Yes, I think this is because we are speaking not from the tongue to the ear, but from the mind to the mind.
Carrie rarely ventured out from the official meetings in palaces and foreign ministries on this trip, but when he did try his hand at public diplomacy at an internet cafe in Berlin, he got a bit carried away as he made the case for free speech and tolerance in America.
In America, you have a right to be stupid, if you want to be.
And that became one of the most quoted phrases of the trip, even making headlines in Iran. The former Massachusetts senator also had a penchant for bringing up his home state whenever he could, even when it came to his choice in neckties.
I like your tie.
you can get it on the internet.
Great, cool.
So it's inspired by my state, Massachusetts.
Okay. Cool.
But the company is actually in Connecticut, next door to me.
Okay.
And I'll tell everybody it's called vineyardvines.com.
Carrie, who is one of the wealthiest cabinet secretaries in the Obama administration, was quick to add he doesn't own any stock in the company. When he visited U.S. embassies in 9 countries on this trip, Kerry often joked that he's a recovering politician. When I asked him what it's like traveling as a diplomat rather than a senator, Kerry made clear he's just getting used to the fact that he can't speak quite as freely.
Each word means more. Each relationship is played differently. And so you have to think, needless to say, about the implications of that in terms of policy and potential missteps. I mean, that you do feel. You know, as a senator, you just don't have those stakes riding on it.
And you're part of a team now, which seems to be very centralizing.
I like being part of a team. I've been part of a team a lot of my life, one way or the other. And I understand hierarchy. I served in the military. I am pleased to be part of President Obama's team.
Well, thank you very much for letting me tag along.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing so. Glad you are.
I'm Michelle Kellerman, traveling with the secretary in Doha, Qatar.
Coming up, the young woman who was raped and murdered in India is remembered and honored. Chinese farmers rise up against their own village chief. And a new airline aims to make travel among African cities convenient at last. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Ted Clark. To mark the occasion of International Women's Day, First Lady Michelle Obama joined Secretary of State John Kerry to recognize women around the world who have shown exceptional courage in advancing women's rights. The 9 honorees include the 23-year-old Indian woman whose brutal gang rape and murder last December inspired a movement to end violence against women in India. From New Delhi, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Her family and the Indian media dubbed the young girl who was being posthumously honored Braveheart. It is illegal in India to name a rape victim. The family has also been advised to withhold its name. As it conferred the International Women of Courage Award, the U.S. State Department called her only Nirbhaya, meaning fearless. The citation describes her as born into a working-class family that invested their hopes and life savings into her dream to pursue medicine. She was on course to become a paramedic. Down a dirt lane in a warren of dwellings in West Delhi sits the small ramshackle house where her family has lived for 30 years. A framed picture of the young woman, propped up against the wall, is garlanded with flowers in the bedroom of her parents. Her father sits on the bed, nursing a sore knee, fondly recalling his daughter as a tiny infant sleeping on his chest. She grew up, he says, to be independent and unafraid. As she lay dying in the hospital, she twice recorded testimony about the rape and repeatedly called for justice against her 6 attackers. I want to live, she told her family. The courage she had and the fight she gave, says her father, told us that we could not be silent, and it told other girls that they must stand up for themselves, save themselves. He added, now all the sleeping girls have been awakened. Women say they won't stay quiet any longer. If injustice happens, they will fight. This is a very big change and a very good thing, he says. 2.5 months on, the ordeal is still raw, the events replaying in their minds. The victim's younger brother, age 20, holds on to the image of his sister fighting back as six men assailed her. When you see six people, anyone would give up. But my sister, the brave heart, didn't. The family has been too pained to attend the trial of the accused, now underway in a Delhi court. The young woman's mother draws her shawl tight and says the award bestowed on her daughter for bravery will have little meaning if the culprits are not convicted. Only the hanging of these criminals is justice, she says. All this public support, the awards, we will understand them and derive some happiness from them when these men are actually hanged. The grisly episode has put its stamp on International Women's Day in India. Poetry readings and street plays like this one performed by Delhi University students portray the humiliation of sexual violence. Feminist Kamla Basin says, the violence will only end when patriarchal attitudes towards women end.
If slavery could be done away with, if monarchies could be done away with, then definitely patriarchy can be done away with if all of us want to do away with it.
Julie McCarthy, NPR News, New Delhi.
Farmers in South China have barricaded themselves in their village. They're demanding free elections. Residents of Shangpu are protesting against their own village chief. They say he sold their land out from under them and then sent armed men to attack them. Government land grabs have become political flashpoints in China, and this is the second village uprising in the region in 15 months. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from inside that barricaded village.
Now I'm entering Shangpu village where the uprising was, and you actually have, we're on a big highway, and you can see all these tents set up. There's actually a wall of rocks and sticks that's set up as a barricade, and there's basically an encampment here to block officials and police from coming in. You can see in front of me burned out cars flipped over, smashed. Wow.
Villagers say the thugs arrived in hard hats for their own protection. Lee, a 60-year-old farmer, is nursing a broken knee, swollen and purple, from a brick he says was thrown by a thug.
When they got out of their cars, they used hose to attack us. We acted in self-defense and threw rocks at them. Afterwards, villagers came out and rang gongs to alert people.
A cell phone video shows the villagers fighting back with bamboo poles from a construction site. You can even hear the gongs. Again, Mr. Lee.
We surrounded them and they ran into the fields beside the road. They were outnumbered. Did you see the cars over there? 29 of them.
Villagers say the thugs were sent to crush opposition before groundbreaking for a new electric cable factory to be built on their fields. Farmers say the village chief, Li Baoyu, sold off the land they were assigned by the government to a local developer. Under a secret contract villagers say they never signed, they were to receive about $1,000 an acre in compensation. But Li says they didn't want to leave the land. Without fields to grow their sweet potatoes, spinach and papaya, they'd have no livelihood.
We can only do some odd jobs making less than $10 a day just to get by. This plot of land should be preserved forever, for generations to come.
The farmers say the village chief was appointed, not elected. They're now negotiating with county officials. A neighbor, also surnamed Li, listed their demands.
Those attackers must be brought to justice. Government employees knowingly approved the project. Those people must take responsibility. What we really hope to see is a legitimate village leader elected through a legitimate process.
Local authorities have been somewhat responsive. Police have arrested the village head and eight of the suspected thugs, according to the newspaper Southern Daily. But villagers say land grabs like this are common, and the answer is a better system. Again, the neighbor, Lee.
This is our current problem in reforming the system in rural areas. Reform means there must be a supervision mechanism. If we had supervision checking on the village committee, it would not have been able to secretly sell the land.
Another problem is rural lawlessness and the tight relationship between business and government. For instance, the man who wants to build the factory is also a local Communist Party chief. As is often the case, the farmers blame local officials and are careful to voice support for the central government. Mr. Li, the one with the broken knee, even worried how this story might play.
If you publish this in America, will it tarnish the Communist Party's image?
Even if the farmers get elections, there's no guarantee it will solve all their problems. The village of Wukong, about 2 hours away, elected its own leaders last year after a similar land grab. But the new officials were inexperienced and have struggled to govern. Lin Zulian is the new village party secretary. In a recent TV interview, he talked about the difficulties of operating amid constant public criticism.
I'm afraid to answer the phone, afraid to see people. If I tell the truth, it doesn't work. If I lie, it's even worse. Everything is hard to say.
The inner workings of government, he says, are complicated. Frank Langford, NPR News, Guangdong Province.
We live in a world where the distance between two points often changes. The number of miles stays the same, of course, but the speed and ease of travel varies widely, with economic consequences. So let's consider the challenge facing Africa, where air travel often involves pricey tickets and erratic service. Now a new airline, FastJet, is trying to change that, starting in Tanzania late last year. Kenya and South Africa are the next destinations, followed by Ghana. NPR's frequent flyer Ophebia Christarkton has our report.
In the U.S., Southwest revolutionized air travel through high-frequency, low-cost flights. FastJet CEO Ed Winter says he's aiming for similar success in Africa.
All of us in the low-cost industry owe a lot to Southwest. We're adapting it for Africa. If you look at the rest of the world, I think Africa is left as the last frontier. Travel opens up so many opportunities, and everybody else in the world has the opportunity to travel on safe, reliable, low-cost airlines. Africans don't.
Winter says fares will average at about $70 to $80, but for those who book early, they could be as low as $20. FastJet began operating flights in Tanzania in late November. It is planning to extend its networks to East, South and West Africa by the end of the year. The CEO says the rationale behind a budget airline for Africa makes perfect business sense.
Every city in Africa has got huge distance between the other one. Mountains, jungles, rivers, deserts, perhaps all of those things between each city, and very rarely a road and almost never a railway. So aviation should be the way people move around. And what there is there was very expensive. So we thought, it looks like there could be something in this.
Ghana is a West African hub, and FastJet is planning to begin flights from here later this year. At the airport in the capital, Accra, Papa Kojobotsu was heading through immigration for a flight back to college in the US. He gave the imminent arrival of a budget airline the thumbs up.
I think it's a really good idea, especially comparing it to the United States, where you can move from state to state at such a low cost. I feel like if there was something like that in Africa, it would make it easier for we Africans to explore our own continent. Yeah.
His lawyer sister, Ma Ruth, who was seeing him off, chimed in.
I think it's great because hitherto, if you want to go to another African country, you may have to travel to Europe or somewhere else to connect to come back into Africa. So I think Continental Budget Airline is a wonderful idea.
How to pay for the tickets could be an issue. In many African countries, including Ghana, prospective passengers carry large amounts of cash for such payments. But that won't work for a budget airline. So FastJet's Ed Winter says they'll incorporate, among other methods, mobile phone money transfers, which are popular in Africa. And the possible pitfalls? West Africans generally don't travel light. So what about baggage restrictions and the no-frills, no-food concept, a new one on the continent? Will that fly? Winter said it did, on the maiden flight in Tanzania.
On the day, worked a dream. People knew that they had to pay for their bag, they paid for a second bag, and we just haven't had a problem. So we changed behaviour already there. Above all, I think a real mantra within the low-cost model is keep it simple.
Fastjets should be joining the flight boarding announcements on that speaker soon. Bon voyage, or should I say, Ghana style, Nantiye. Ophelia Quistarkton, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.